Hi, this is Meg Malone, the Vermont Edition digital producer, and you're listening to the Vermont Edition podcast. This episode has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today, we're continuing the podcast from New Hampshire Public Radio called Supervision. Yesterday, we met parolee Josh Lavinetz. If you missed that part, you can hear it at vpr.org. When we last heard from Josh, he had just left the hospital after an unexpected medical emergency, and reporter Emily Corwin was worried.
The last time I saw Josh was at the hospital. I was surprised and confused by the way the day had played out. I was nervous for his health and safety after his seizures, and I had forgotten to figure out how to reach him.
I'm worried about this guy. I don't know. I don't even know how I'm going to follow up with Josh. He doesn't even have a phone number.
See, I used to be able to call the prison to get a hold of Josh. Now he's out. And as far as I can tell, he doesn't have a phone. There is one person I hope will be able to help me find Josh. Someone whose actual job it is to keep track of him.
My name is Greg Morginus, and I'm a probation parole officer for the state of New Hampshire. And Josh is one of my parole subjects.
Out of how many?
Right now, I have about 140 people.
By the way, that number is a little high for Greg. He usually supervises about 110 people at a time, which, if you couldn't guess, is a lot. And maybe because he sees so many parolees, I'm struck when Greg says he had the same first impression of Josh that I did, that this guy seemed genuinely determined to do better.
When I first met him, I'm thinking, oh, he's going to do all right and he'll stay out of trouble, but he really struggled that first week.
The day I left Josh at the hospital, he went straight to a county-run dormitory, sort of like a government-subsidized group home for former inmates. Josh needed a place to live, but...
But was kicked out for some behavioral issues. I think maybe the second night he was there.
I was stunned. Just 2 days out of prison, Josh got kicked out of his transitional housing. It was not a good sign for whatever lay ahead for Josh on the outside. I wanted to know more about the behavioral issues Greg said led to Josh's eviction. But he was cagey.
Like, can you put it into a category, like, violated a parole condition, or...
It was a parole condition, substance-related.
Substance-related, wow.
So... Right off the bat, I'm like, wow, this guy, he hasn't made any changes. You know, it was in 48 hours of getting out. So it was a surprise to me.
I can only imagine it was a surprise to Josh, too. On his first day of freedom, he's rushed to the hospital because of seizures. 2 days later, he's homeless. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Supervision, a podcast about a life on parole. I'm Emily Corwin. This is Episode 3, Losing Josh. I'm almost certain the substance that got Josh Lavinetz kicked out is alcohol. Back in prison, Josh told me he really wanted to avoid alcohol. When he gets depressed, he drinks too much. And he gets in trouble. Josh was depressed and drinking when he lost his driver's license and when he assaulted his wife and stepson. Josh could have stayed at that county-run dormitory rent-free for a whole month. It would have given him a roof over his head, 2 meals a day, transportation to job interviews, and medical appointments. When Josh was kicked out, he lost all that support. Now, if he wants to rent an apartment, he'll need a deposit, money he doesn't have. Plus, he'll probably have to check off convicted felon on the application. But this revelation about Josh's drinking, it's shocking to me for another reason. Drinking is a violation of his parole. It means Josh has already done something that could send him back to prison.
Most of his crimes are domestic violence related, a lot of misdemeanors.
It's a parole officer's job to decide what happens next. Sitting in his office, Morginus pulls out a folder and rifles through papers documenting Josh's crimes.
So yeah, you look at his record and you see criminal mischief and simple assault and obstructing the report of a crime and simple assault. It's all domestic violence related.
Parole officers like Morginus have a ton of discretion when it comes to how they handle violations. They can initiate new felony charges in the courts, suggest a setback of 30 or 90 days in prison, or they can just make a note and basically let it go.
It's hard because we have a dual role. We are here to enforce the conditions of the court, the parole board, but we're also here to assist and help someone along. So it's a fine line to be able to do that.
The job of a parole officer like Greg Morginus exists somewhere on a spectrum between law enforcement and social work. When someone messes up, do you lock them up or do you give them more support? It can be pretty arbitrary. It can come down to the parole officer's personality, his mood, or the identity of the parolee. There's research that shows black people on parole are far more likely to end up back in prison than white people. Josh is white. Morginus says 18 years ago, when he started doing this work, he sent a lot more guys back to prison. Now, he uses his discretion differently. He says what changed for him was becoming a dad.
Going in the field, especially, and seeing kids in horrible situations, it really kind of got to me. And over time, I've had grandparents and parents and the kids. I've had, you know, three generations of people on supervision. And, you know, I've had kids in here where they color and I give them lollipops. And it's a day out to the probation officer instead of, you know, going to the dentist or the doctor. So it's normal for them. And, you know, when they're 18 and 25, it's going to be normal for them at that age and for their kids to be here. So it's a generational thing. And it's hard to watch that with really no ability to break that cycle.
Parole officer assignments are luck of the draw. And Josh may have hit the jackpot with this one. After getting drunk on his second day out, Morginus could have sent Josh straight back to prison. But he didn't. He gave Josh another chance. So, I lost Josh. I can't find him. It's been 7 days since I last saw him at the hospital. I call the only person I can think of. Chris.
Hello?
Hey, Chris, this is Emily, the reporter with New Hampshire Public Radio. So I've been trying to find Josh. Do you have any advice for me for how to get in touch with him?
Best to text message him, and what I'll do is I'll text him.
Josh, it turns out, has a phone.
Hey, Josh, this is Emily, the reporter with NHPR. I've been trying to find you.
Josh tells me a friend offered him a room in her apartment in Rochester, New Hampshire, Josh's hometown. He doesn't mention getting kicked out of transitional housing. But he does agree to meet up at 9 a.m. the next morning at a Dunkin' Donuts near his friend's place.
How about this little stone bench?
We stroll through Rochester Commons and find a bench near a playground. Josh tells me he used to bring his son here to play.
To the playground.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This isn't the stepson he was convicted of assaulting, but a biological son who's being raised by his mother in a city an hour away. Josh hasn't seen the kid, who's 16 now, since he went to prison 2 years ago. But they've been video chatting since Josh got out, catching up.
This program he's in doing, they do hikes. He told me he did a couple of the presidentials. That's what I said. I was like, your dad hasn't even done those yet.
Pretty proud?
Yes. Technology is great. You know, you can have a face-to-face conversation with them on the phone. It's pretty neat.
Josh is tickled by technology. Every few minutes, he pulls his phone out to check for new messages.
Who are you texting with?
Fathead.
That's Fathead, a friend. Josh has known Fathead since middle school.
It's been good. A lot has happened. You should stop by.
For the last 2 years, Josh has had no connection with the people he cares about most. No email, no visits, hardly a letter. And now, all of a sudden, everyone is at his fingertips. It's hard to keep Josh's attention when all his friends are texting at once.
Doobie doobie doo. Chris just text me in a post. He wants to do Middle Carter.
Chris wants to hike a mountain with Josh, but it's under a few feet of snow, right, and Josh doesn't have any boots right now. He texts something back. Another reason Josh has his phone out is he's waiting for the neurologist to call him today. No calls yet.
Yeah, since that seizure, I've been wicked mush brain, like mushy brain. I've noticed that I've been forgetting a lot of things.
Really?
Yep.
Still, Josh doesn't seem too stuck on the seizure thing. I mean, there's a lot of things he's happy about.
I love laundry, I love shopping, I love cooking, I love doing all the things, the little chores of everyday life.
Really?
I really appreciate it.
It's these little details that remind me how different Josh's life was on the inside. It's like getting kicked out of a group home pales in comparison to laundry and fresh produce.
Fruits. I love eating fruit. All of it. And in prison, they don't serve you fruit. They're so afraid of making alcohol that they will malnourish you.
Wow, so what do you do? How do you get fruit now? What's yours?
The grocery store, which is wonderful.
Have you gotten your check from the prison, by the way?
No.
This check from the prison is something Josh has talked a lot about with me. He was supposed to get out with $100 in his pocket, money he earned working in the prison. But instead of handing him the money when he left, they said they'd have to send it to him in the mail.
I called them yesterday, matter of fact, and they said, well, you gotta call Concord. Concord told me Berlin hasn't sent it yet. They're as useless on the outside as they are on the inside.
Without the check, Josh is completely broke.
I hate not being able to pitch in, like freeloading. I've never been like that.
And right now, who do you feel like you're freeloading from?
Everybody.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today on the program, we're listening to Supervision, a podcast from New Hampshire Public Radio. We left off with parolee Josh Lavinetz, struggling to get the money he needs that he earned while working in prison. Emily Corwin takes us back to the story as Josh goes shopping.
Today, Josh has $14 in his pocket, thanks to his mom. With it, he needs to buy a new wardrobe. Trisha Angel, the friend he's crashing with, is going to take us to Goodwill. So we leave the park and walk back to Josh's new apartment, Trisha's place.
Nice to meet you.
Sure,
come on. Josh hadn't mentioned Trish before today, but when I meet her, they seem tight.
So you guys went to all through elementary
middle school?
Middle school.
Grab the pictures. You got to show her. It's kind of funny. Yeah, we're pretty inseparable for a long time.
This is you, Josh?
Yeah.
Black hair?
His hair is really, it used to be really dark. And it gets curly. It gets really curly, actually.
Trish cleans houses and works for a temp agency. She has three kids. Two live with their dad. The oldest is in high school and lives with her, and now, I guess, with Josh. The apartment is tidy. I can see all of Josh's things have been neatly placed on the couch. His sweat shorts from the prison, and a plastic bag with dirty underwear and socks. I get why he's so keen to buy more clothes.
Josh, can you move that for her, or unless you want her to sit up front?
No, no, I'll sit in the back.
You're going to replace it anyways.
We pile in the car, and Trish drives us to Goodwill.
I've not been in this one, so.
And you're good.
Yeah, what's she looking for?
Large to extra large. I don't like tight. I don't like tight clothes. Anything besides having nothing.
Josh only has the $14 from his mom. Even at Goodwill, that's not going to go very far.
I don't know what green tag means. I know this is $3. I don't know. This is either $5 or up and $6.
It's hard to figure out the prices here, and Josh is starting to look anxious when he gets totally engrossed in something else on his phone.
Come on. No, why?
Who are you texting?
My ex.
This isn't just an ex. This is the ex. The one Josh was charged with strangling. The one he was convicted of assaulting. Assaulting her son, locking her in a bedroom. The one who divorced him while he was doing time. Josh's clothes, his hiking boots, his kayak, they're in her garage.
I'm just trying to get my stuff back. She's starting the whole, oh, I've always loved you thing, and I'm
all really?
Set. I'm all set.
She's
starting to talk mushy, and I'm just not down with that.
Wow.
Josh lost his job, went to prison, and is here at Goodwill buying clothes with 14 borrowed dollars because of crimes he committed against her.
Any temptation?
No. I have no desires. No. I want my life back. I was unhappy when I was with her. 32s, that's it. I can't go any smaller. My pants, they all look dirty. Is that the style or is that? I
think they're supposed to. Josh takes his t-shirt, shorts, and pants to the checkout line.
Question. Green, that means $3?
Nope.
I mean, it's $5.
$5.
And $6.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Josh is worried his $14 won't be enough. But it is. He spends it all.
Comes to 14. Did you want to round that up to 15 for our veterans today?
Oh, I does. 15.
And your receipt. Have a great day.
You too. There.
When we get outside, Josh seems relieved, lighter. But by the time we get to the car, he's fretting again about the $100 the prison still owes him.
I wanted Chinese food, but because I didn't get my check, they didn't send me my check.
Chinese.
I was going to take my mom out. Can't do that.
Have you gone out for any meals?
No. I haven't had money.
I think the funniest things was I cooked a ham, and he's like, "This is
Trish
like my first."
Trish seems intent on giving Josh a good homecoming.
Like, forever. So
the more I watch them together
in
the car, the more I see how much they love each other, whether like brother and sister or something else. It's hard to tell.
Mine and like our music choice completely different. I hate his music. It's absolutely the worst.
What do you mean?
And like his music, he hates my music. It's a constant. It has forever. Like, since day one, been an issue with our music.
They say they've dated off and on. And yet, like Josh's mom, his siblings, Chris, and everyone else, Trish didn't visit Josh in the 2 years he spent in prison. I ask her why not.
Berlin is really far. I absolutely would have gone up more had I thought that, like, it's just so far. It's 2 hours away.
Trish says her car had some issues. Also, her ex didn't like Josh, disapproved of her going to visit him. Josh doesn't say anything.
Like, one of the things was you can't wear tank tops, so, like, I layer tank tops under shirts, so it's, like, what's acceptable, what's not.
When we get back to their apartment, Josh makes himself a peanut butter sandwich. It's time for me to go.
Yeah.
Dawn upon me, you didn't even have my number, and I was just... I don't even think my parole officer has my number yet.
We agree to be in touch by phone. I tell Josh I want to know what's coming up in his life so I can be there to record. Job prospects, doctor's appointments, whatever.
Yeah, anything else on the horizon I should know about?
No.
All right. So do you mind if I, like, I think I might just sort of get into the habit of, like, sort of checking in regularly and just be like, what's new today? Seeing if there's anything I want to, you know, run over.
I'm certain I'll see him soon. What I don't know in this moment in the hallway is that I won't see Josh soon. I'll text him, and he'll write back things like, I'm working all the time. He'll make excuses about why he can't meet up. Communication will get sketchy. What I wish I knew, standing there with Josh Lavinitz, is that I will never see him again. And looking back, if I had known this was going to be goodbye, I would have said something else. Maybe thank you. Or at least, good luck.
Do you know how to get back? Want me to walk you back?
Because
you can see Dunkin' Donuts.
Yeah, yeah.
Right
I'll be fine. Yeah. I see it. Cool. All right. Good.
For 7 years before Josh went to prison, he had a job he loved. He worked at a Christmas tree farm, a big one. Some years, the farm sold 3,000 trees in a season. Josh loved it because he was outdoors, on his own, all day, planting and mowing.
He was a small guy, but he was super strong. He was super high energy.
Rick Zielfelder, who owns the farm, started out with just 2 employees. And Rick says Josh outworked his own manager.
He worked circles around the other person, and we had to make a tough decision, and we chose to move forward with Josh. I mean, it was because of personality was super comfortable. His work ethic was amazing. He blew me away with how hard a worker he was.
About a week before he got out of prison, Josh and I talked on the phone. He knew getting a good job on the outside could keep him out of trouble. I asked what kind of work he might get, you know, once he got out.
Before I got into this mess, I was working on a tree farm, a Christmas tree plantation in Farmington.
Are they people who you think you might be able to work for in the future?
Well, Rick really wasn't impressed that I got in trouble.
That was pretty much all Josh said about the tree farm at the time. I figured his boss there just didn't like what he had done to get arrested. Josh changed the subject.
Kenny says he'll take me back roofing, and I know a guy named Paul. He might be able to get me on a lobster boat. So
yeah.
I have some options.
Josh has to find a job, and it's not just because he needs money. It's actually one of his parole conditions. His best chance to get a job now that he's got a felony record is going to be through someone he already knows, someone from his past. And not everyone Josh knows is on the up and up. Honestly, I hope he calls the tree farm guy. But he won't. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is the final episode of Supervision, a podcast about a life on parole. I'm Emily Corwin. At the end of the last episode, I told you that that moment in the hallway was the last time I ever saw Josh. Before I tell you what happened, I need to back up a little bit. I need to tell you more about the tree farm. Rick Zielfelder is a gentle guy. He speaks carefully. I called him recently, and he agreed to meet up at his office. He owns a motorcycle suspension shop. The tree farm is more of a hobby.
So those first years were Josh as we knew Josh. Over time, some things started to change, and we didn't know what, when, why.
Rick says early on, Josh was a part of the team. At lunchtime, Rick's family and all of the employees would sit together to eat bagged lunches from home.
There's a lot of fields out there, and at a point in time, it became Josh would get in his car, drive to a far corner, and sit by himself. And I don't know what he was doing. I look back now and have to wonder what he was doing, but I don't know.
Josh also started showing up to work with sketchy-looking friends, or not showing up at all. A couple times, he missed work because of what Rick calls temporary lockups, scuffles with the law.
Even his demeanor was different, and that's why we did speculate there was something going on in the background, because that wasn't the personality of the person that we knew early on.
Rick started losing trust in Josh. He gave Josh assignments in the office so he could keep an eye on him.
At the end, Josh just disappeared, right? There was no call, there was no text, there was no communication.
That would have been early January 2015, about the same time Josh was arrested for assaulting his wife and stepson. After 3 months in jail, a judge let Josh out to wait at home for a trial and sentencing. That's when Josh did something. Without announcing himself, he showed up back at the Christmas tree farm.
He'd got released. He'd got together with his wife. He showed up at the... He was into Subaru rally cars as well. He thought it'd be fun to go out in the fields and power his car around the fields in the snow. And there was way too much snow. He buried the car. He couldn't find keys to tractors at our place or a neighbor's place. And he had to call me at that point saying, hey, can you help me get my car out, and we hadn't heard from him in months at that point, and this is how we find out you're around again.
They had to tow Josh's car out of the snow at night. The next morning, he came back to pick it up, and that was goodbye.
There was no communication. That was just the last contact.
No thanks, no nothing. Josh loved this job. It gave him a sense of purpose. But just a couple months out of prison, he can't seem to bring himself to ask Rick for the job back. And Josh really needs a job. Right now, he's crashing with his friend Trish and borrowing money from his mom for food.
I'm starting to get really desperate for work right now, so I'll probably go roofing. But everybody doesn't want me to do that.
Wait, talk about that.
Well, this roofing company I used to work for, I got in trouble.
Josh says he knows a guy who'll hire him. The guy who owns the roofing company, Kenny Stanley.
None of his vehicles are ever registered or inspected, and nobody has driver's licenses, and they're all, you know, bad drug habits.
Before Josh's 7 years at the tree farm, he worked for this guy. Now, Josh's family and friends are saying, don't do it. What information I could find about Kenny is not good. His roofing company has been fined $385,000 for federal health and safety violations. And Kenny himself has had at least 33 cases against him in New Hampshire courts. They're small claims cases, simple assaults, violating a protective order, menacing dogs, you name it. Kenny pays people under the table, and Josh says the other employees use drugs. To be clear, just being around drugs is a violation of Josh's parole conditions. It could send him back to jail. And there's this one thing that happened while Josh was working for Kenny way back when that makes his family and friends nervous now. See, back then, just like today, Josh had a DWI.
I didn't have a license. Nobody had a license, and he was freaking out, yelling at everybody.
So this anecdote Josh is about to describe, I couldn't find a record of it. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. I can tell you Josh does have a drug charge on his record. And the state has charged Kenny with both allowing an improper person to operate a vehicle and with failing to get his vehicles inspected. Anyway, according to Josh, Kenny asked him to drive some guys to a job.
He asked, but it was pretty much a do it or lose your job way.
I see. All right. So they told you to drive?
Yes. We had a job in Massachusetts, and we were going through the toll booth, and there was a state cop standing at the toll. You know, I guess he was checking stickers, and of course, no stickers, and cracked windshield. And sure enough, I was in handcuffs, getting charged. I thought I was just going to get charged with driving on a license, but nope, it turned in a little more serious than that.
Josh says another guy in the car had methadone on him, illegal methadone. Josh was charged with possession.
Yeah, I've never done this stuff in my life. I try pleading my case, but can't afford a lawyer. So you get a public defender that works for the state, and it's just a big setup. It's just a losing battle. Unless you have a lot of money, yeah.
Josh says he pleaded guilty. That was more than 10 years ago. Now, Josh is 5 weeks out of prison, and I can't find him. I reach out to Trish, who he was living with, and she tells me he moved. Her landlord kicked him out. So I call Chris, Josh's friend, who picked him up that first day out of prison.
Hello.
Hey, Chris, it's Emily.
Hi.
Josh, he says, is struggling. After he left Trish's place in Rochester, he went to Milton, the next town north, to live in his stepdad's basement.
Milton? What's in Milton? I mean, you need a car. You need a license if you want to do anything in Milton.
Rochester, a city with 30,000 people, at least has public buses and an actual downtown. Milton is an old mill town, population 4,000. The downtown consists of a gas station, a dollar store, a Dunkin' Donuts, and a pizza place. That's it. It's isolating. Without a car or a license, it's hard to imagine Josh getting a job or keeping up with friends. Then Chris tells me Josh is working for a roofing company.
This roofing company, though, like, this isn't the same company that he got in trouble with before. Like, it's not the same guy, is it?
Yeah, I think it is.
It's the same guy. Oh.
So Josh is working for Kenny. Like everyone in Josh's life, Chris doesn't want him to work for Kenny's company. And Chris claims he has a great job lined up for Josh, doing construction.
All he has to do is make a phone call, and he can have a job in Portsmouth for 2 years, making $36 an hour. You think Josh would make that phone call? And he just hasn't done it. I'm like, dude, all you got to do is call. Like, I talked to the guy today. I said, are you hiring? He goes, we can't get enough people here.
Chris is obviously frustrated. But if there's one thing I know about Josh, it's that he hates relying on other people. What I might think of as a favor, he would call mooching. And I have a feeling the only way he could get to this sweet job in Portsmouth is if Chris drove up to Milton to give him a ride every morning. Instead, Josh is working for Kenny. Even though Josh isn't returning my phone calls, he does respond to my texts and Facebook messages. I reach out every few days. Usually, he writes back to say he'll call me later, or that he's roofing all over New England, and he never knows if or when he'll get a day off. But he does give me updates, like that he finally received the $100 the prison owed him. And he says things are going pretty good with his parole officer, Greg. At one point, Josh messages me to say, I work with a bunch of junkies. Later, I see Chris post a public comment on Josh's wall. It's an article in a local paper about Kenny's roofing company. The headline reads, Roofing Contractor Faces Fines for OSHA Violations. In the comments, Chris writes, Go union or go home in a bag. Josh replies, quote, LOL, in a bag. Death is everywhere. Two weeks later, at 9 a.m. on a Monday morning, I'm eating breakfast with my mom when the phone rings. It's Chris. I pick up, but don't think to record the call. When I answer, Chris tells me, Josh is dead. In a voice more monotone than usual, he lays out his hazy understanding of what happened. He says he'd gone hiking with Josh that very weekend, and Josh seemed fine. Last night, Chris says, Josh was drinking heavily with friends. And then this morning, he was found dead, where he was living in his stepdad's basement.
I just went outside to smoke a cigarette.
A few weeks later, Chris tells me how he found out Josh died.
I sent him a message, and his stepmother responded back to me under his messenger icon and said, this is his stepmother, just call me at this number.
What did you think was happening right then?
I thought he went back to prison. So thought he had maybe, you know, drank some beers and his parole officer just randomly happened to show up, which they can do.
And then what happens next?
I called her and she told me that he died last night, and I was just like...
I have only one document that tells me anything about what happened that night, and it doesn't even establish Josh's cause of death. But it has a lot of details. It's graphic, and it's sad. It's the police report, essentially just one officer's narrative from the night he died. Here's what it says. Josh spent that day sitting around a fire pit in his step-parents' yard, drinking significant amounts of beer. He was with his stepsister, her boyfriend, and a friend. That friend, Brandon, stuck around with Josh after the others went home. Around 2 a.m., Josh, very drunk, went downstairs to do laundry. This is a detail that seems to me somehow very Josh. After that, Brandon said he heard a loud thump. When he went downstairs, he found Josh unconscious and unresponsive. He called 911 and started CPR. When Milton police officer Carrie Driscoll showed up, she wrote she could smell alcohol and vomit. She saw Josh on his back with vomit on his face and pooled around his head. She took over CPR and checked for a pulse. She couldn't find one. Paramedics arrived and attached Josh to a ventilator. Officer Driscoll watched vomit come out of his lungs. Right there, in the basement, Josh was declared dead at 2:52 a.m. Officer Driscoll waited 20 minutes for the assistant deputy medical examiner to arrive. She speculated to Driscoll that acute alcohol overdose and airway obstruction from the vomit were likely factors in Josh's death. This police report, it's 3 pages long, and it's all I have. The medical examiner told the police officer they'd need to do an autopsy and a toxicology report to determine Josh's cause of death. I can't get those documents. Josh's family can, but when I ask his mom to share them, she stops responding to me. That means I don't have answers to my biggest questions. Did seizures play a role in his death? I don't know. Was he on any other drugs that night? I don't know. Here's what I do know. Josh's friend Chris told me Josh never mentioned any more seizures after that first day out of prison. And Josh's mom, before she stopped talking to me, she told me a doctor had taken Josh off an antidepressant that's known to cause seizures. I also know the people who were with Josh the night he died told police what Josh had told me so many times, that Josh didn't do drugs, except for pot. And his friend said Josh hadn't smoked pot that night. Josh had always said his problem is alcohol. And from what I saw, he was right. Josh was drunk when he committed the crimes that sent him to prison. And when he insulted his employer by getting his car stuck at the tree farm. He was most likely drunk when he lost his housing. And he was drunk when he died. I'm left shocked and grieving. I was rooting for Josh. I never saw him when he was depressed or drunk or off his meds. The Josh I got to know, despite his crimes, he was still lovable, earnest, candid, sometimes silly. And right now, all I want to do is talk about him with the people who knew him. At one point, I even call Kenny, the guy Josh had been working for, roofing. He agrees to meet me at a job site.
Hey.
Hello.
Are you Sean?
Sean is up here. Sean!
Is Kenny up here?
Kenny isn't here yet.
Oh, he's not there yet. Okay, do you know if he's coming?
Yeah, he's coming.
Okay.
I wait for Kenny. An hour passes. Then another.
Are you waiting for Kenny?
Yeah.
For 4 hours, I wait for Kenny.
Another hour?
Kenny doesn't show. It's not till I meet up with Rick from the tree farm months later that I find someone else who's craving details the way I am. He tells me he's been trying to figure out what happened to Josh. He hasn't been sure if he's alive or dead. When I break the news, Rick seems relieved just to know the truth.
The rumor we had heard was it was a hiking accident, and we knew he loved to hike. That part was very believable. So I continued to search for hiking accidents, and I couldn't find anything. And when you called, you were the first person that said, yes, he is in fact gone.
Now Rick and I both know how Josh died. But I still want to know why. Why did Josh have to die? If just one more thing had gone right, would he be alive today?
What do you think would have happened if, hypothetically speaking, he had given you a call and said, you know, I'm out of prison and I really need a job?
I don't know.
Josh had told me Rick was too disappointed in him to give him a second chance. Rick says that's not fair. I think Josh's shame stood in the way of him even asking the question.
I don't have ill feelings towards Josh. Was I frustrated when Josh disappeared and then he showed up the way he did? Yes. But I am still shocked that he's not here.
Thank you. It takes a while for Chris to agree to meet up with me. In the months since Josh was paroled, Chris had gotten married and had a baby girl. We meet at the same park where Josh had taken me a few months back. The same park where Josh took his son to the playground a dozen years ago. Today, Chris and his wife are struggling to open a brand new stroller. She's going to walk the baby around the park while he and I talk. You want to sit down?
No, it's all right.
No?
Yeah, I'm good.
All right, I'll stand. I try to get close with my microphone, but he's keeping his distance. As far as I can tell, Chris was Josh's closest friend. He coordinated Josh's cremation, spread some of his ashes on Josh's favorite mountains. But Chris doesn't want to wrestle with it any longer. And that makes sense. He's focused on his daughter now.
Not too many people set up a cremation on Monday and then catch a baby on Tuesday. So August was a little tough for me.
Chris and I go back and forth about the details of Josh's death, just trying to make sense of it. And it makes me think of something I read on the internet while I was casting about, looking for an explanation. I had found this study. It showed that inmates are way more likely than other people their age to go to the ER and to die in the weeks and months after their release from prison. Not just from overdoses, but from all kinds of things. And one reason people think that is that prison trains you to be passive. But on the outside, you have to advocate for yourself. And Chris and I both saw how Josh struggled with that.
You feel like when it came to the seizures and figuring that out, Josh was able to get to all the doctor's appointments he had and needed to go to? And if he needed a ride, you think he would have asked for a ride?
Well, I mean, he wouldn't have asked me. He knows that there's nothing I can do when I'm at work. I mean, I just leave. So my career is very important to me. An income is very important to me. Stability is very important to me. All those things kind of revolve around being where I'm required to be for X amount of dollars.
Do you think he had anybody he could ask for a ride to a doctor's appointment?
I don't know.
I'm not implying a car ride would have saved Josh's life. But I keep coming back to those same logistics the parole board asked every parolee about, including Josh. Where will you live? Will you have a car? A job? Who will be there to help you? Chris, Josh's mom, and Trish wanted to visit Josh in prison, wanted to pick him up on his first day out, wanted to drive him where he couldn't drive himself. But they couldn't always be there for him. And Josh didn't want to mooch. He didn't want to be in anyone's way. And then there's the system. It let Josh out on parole, then expected him to do things the best of us would struggle at. Get a job without a driver's license. Don't associate with felons, even though most of the guys you work with have criminal records. Don't drink, even though you're an adult with a drinking problem. So all of it, the bad luck, the poor choices, and the expectations of the parole board itself, it all pushed Josh into an increasingly vulnerable position. And it was in that position, on August 7th, 2017, Josh died. We'll never know what Josh would have wanted. He had high hopes for this project. He wanted to tell his story. So here's Josh's story. He lived a life on parole for 3 months before he died. In that time, he stayed out of prison. Although it may not have been a safe job, and it may not have paid very much, Josh worked to support himself. He made a lot of mistakes on the outside, mistakes he paid for, in prison and after. The Josh I got to know was striving to do better, to be better. And even in those hard months, he found moments of joy and purpose. just a few days before he died, Josh climbed another mountain.
You've been listening to Supervision, a podcast produced and reported by Emily Corwin. The full series is online now. We have links at vpr.org. Supervision is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Jack Rodolico is senior producer, editing by Dan Barrick, Corey Princell, and Maureen McMurray. Digital production by Sarah Plord and Rebecca Lavoie. Sound mixing by Nick Capodice and Hannah McCarthy. Supervision was supported by a grant from the New Hampshire Bar Foundation. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Matthew Smith. Our show producers are Mary Angish, Jake Rusnak, and Mary Carol Maganzini. And VPR's digital producers are Meg Malone and Elodie Reed. Our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.